was teaching at St. Louis University, and we asked him for some poems, and he gave us some poems, and John Nofel was in the first issue of River Styx. So it's really auspicious, I think, that we have him back at this 10th anniversary season. He's since moved across the river, but has remained in his poetry rooted in the rhythms of nature, the rhythms of speech, the rhythms of thought that are part of this place and this region. It's a great pleasure to introduce to you one of the finest poets of any region, John Nofel.
I'm going to read some selections from a group of poems called Poems from the Sangamon, which will be published by the University of Illinois Press in September of 85. So like hotcakes. Sangamon Valley is about 200 miles long, runs across central Illinois. It's an interesting area and unusually political for its size. So there's a lot of politics in the poetry and a lot of attention to the history of the area. I'm a kind of recorder of what goes on there, and at some pains not to intrude too much into the work. It's called East in McLean County, which is where the Sangamon rises. This is a country of moraines. Old prairie could have gone on forever. Mounds, timbers, points, groves, islands, savannas, a language of prairies. Farmhouses on the high places, barns, outbuildings washed in the clear air. Cornfields and soybeans, enough for everyone. East of Ellsworth, an Osage orange hedge stiffens the curve of the earth. Four crows carry the sky away, cawing. There's a doubleness in the book, comes from a remark in Edgar Lee Masters' a prose account of the Sangamon. He says that there's always something there that you think you've experienced before. So it's a poem called Saturday Morning. It is as if you were walking the top of creation, or you could jog these moraines forever. The river is ditched here, an interrupted line on the map, still green to the eye, though, and crowding its slender grasses. The old channel insinuates itself through cornfields, loops across and back, or coils alongside the ditch, still roaming its old valley. Telephone cables overhead catch the gust of a storm. The gray light of morning whines. You turn, searching for something that should be there. When we went up to see the headwaters, we found a turtle in the culvert there. These are the big snapping turtles. Culvert has a turtle in it, snapper with a thick neck. They get old. He has a grim smile, like someone who has been around a long time, who admires his enemies and distrusts any friends. He has a tyrannosaur back and a heart for his hide. He is a survivor. It is no wonder he stands for the earth. He is the wise one. He knows which way the river runs. Now, the first European to come into the general area was Father Marquette. He made the trip on the Mississippi, but then later he came down because he wished to preach to the Illinois, but was detained in winter camp on the Chicago River in 1675 from an illness that ultimately carried him off. While he was there, he wrote this letter to his superior. I've shaped it from a translation in Life of Marquette. I know one of two things. God will break me because I have been afraid, or he will give me his cross, which I have not borne since I came to this country. The Blessed Immaculate Virgin will beg this for me, or God will speak my death, and I will stop offending him. I try to be ready, putting myself in his hands. Pray for me, and pray God will keep me grateful. He has spoiled me always with so many favors. Now, among the people who first heard him may have been the Tamarora, and they're a branch of the Illinois Confederacy, and inhabited as a hunting ground the Sangamon Valley. There is extant a checklist of 200 words in Illinois, plus a counting system, and a few sentences plus the Lord's Prayer. Now, how would they have understood it? After all, there are people where the father does not raise the children. So we try to transpose their sense of this in this poem. You should know that by 1690 they were almost destroyed as a people by a terrifying raid by the Iroquois in the Illinois Valley, and the remnant merged with the Cahokia, and they ceased to be an identifiable part of the culture of the valley. So Tamaroa prayer. Let those who live with you in your home in that other world honor what they call you. Let them listen to you when you come to light your fire, and we will kindle our fires as the year rounds in green corn. Give us enough to eat when the winter starves us. Even the inside bark of the white oak would nourish us. Do not remember how we forget you, and our enemies we will forget them thinking of you. Come out of your house and stay with us in summer, or we will be spoiled in the months of plenty, and you will be angry with us. Walk with your arm around us as if you would adopt us when that time raves from an ambush that we had not foreseen and kills us with its arrows. These phrases are from a book of pioneer recollections called Old Times in McLean County. This is called Old Settlers' Day, Buckles Grove. Dollar and a quarter, that little, bought an acre of land. Peter Cartwright marked his way blazing trees with a hook knife. Andrew Jackson, he was Wall's freed slave, killed a bloodhound on the Ohio bank. That's how he escaped to Illinois. He ended up exhorter, you know, in the Baptist church. There were rolling fires on the prairie. Wife rocked the baby in the sugar trough. Plowshares were cold hammered iron, had 5 yoke of oxen, 5 board fence on 3 sides, a 30-acre plot, set fall door traps for prairie chickens. I danced with the Pottawatomies. That was before their death march. Now, Peter Cartwright was the Methodist preacher who evangelized the valley in the 1840s. He came up out of the South because he was afraid his children might marry into slaveholding families. Some of you may have seen the first television show of, I think it's Bonanza. The Cartwrights are descendants from Peter, and the whole thing starts in Pleasant Plains, Illinois, where he is buried. Anyway, this is a found poem. Nothing has been changed except I put it in lines, and it's called Peter Cartwright's Dream. Monday in my night visions, I thought I went on a fishing expedition, and I drew up and threw out many excellent fish. At length, I felt that a large fish or something else had got hold of my hook. I began to draw whatever it was out, but it came slow and pulled heavy. At length I drew it to land, and behold, it was a large mud turtle. I awoke, and lo, it was a dream, and I was glad of it. Terrifying dream for a preacher, I think. He wrote an autobiography which is full of a very handsome idiomatic language, and I try to catch some of this in this poem, Circuit Preacher, Lines After Cartwright. I should say that he doesn't mix his metaphors in his autobiography, and they are mixed here. I just want to say the country was in an agony of salvation, and I was a lost sheep bleeding around the walls in a gang by myself. There was an awful shaking among the dry bones. They waked me up on all sides, and I became the great deep of a sinner, a heart broken. The devil drank to a dead hog that day, but I swallowed Ezekiel and tasted his bitter honey. The old hive has sent forth 20 swarms since then. I won't lean in front of you now on a broken staff. So it's a rural country, but it has atomic power plants in it, things like that. This is called Technology as a Spider Webbed in Wild Roses. There's a reference to the Fermi lab here, and I guess I should explain that when I visited the lab and we went down deep underground and saw the control room with all the lights blinking on and off, such awesome power. Well, up close to the window, there was a plastic Christmas tree, and next to it was a can of pine scent. So. There's also a reference to a Kickapoo myth here, that once when the earth was falling from the heavens, the spiders caught it in their nets and held it in the universe. And the Kickapoo, even to this day, will not wantonly kill spiders. So, the inception of the poem comes because we saw the headwaters, both of the Sangamon and of the South Fork, in the fall, and they were webbed over with the garden spiders, orb weavers. Gazetteers for a heavenly city with small copper coins in the roadways. These webs manifest the ineffable quark that will not be shattered. A Fermi lab exaltation amazing almost as a hand. The control room glittering under earth, its plastic Christmas tree, aerosol bomb of pine scent where eyelets are stitched to the hours. These spiders are the sixth order of the angels. They wave here by right because once in this valley, when earth fell from the skies, they bound it to the stars. Now they mold them to the air, these webs commanding our headwaters. They lock them in place forever, deep down complexities drenched by the red waking sun. Set of directions. It's called Follow These Directions. Go right on 975 east to Horse Creek. At 1055, the Pet Paradise Cemetery. You can bury your rat there. On the New City Road, an abandoned farmhouse. It has three chimneys. Cross Sangamon South Fork, fishing shacks on the right in the woods. Country Trail Subdivision. Sign says it sucks. A lot of small farmers going bankrupt. This is the one called Farm Auction. It's from an earlier chapbook, and I was able to work it back into this collection. Snowflakes, they come watching this rural farewell. Farmholders standing in peaked caps, raw hands pocketed, auctioning off blizzards, the snow feathered on the back screen door, and on mirrors a fence slants. Farm wife looking down now, staring at a kerchief, her face receding through furries and unmarked land. Winter is sleet in her heart, selling on despair, but the snow prodigal, a man a nobody needs like a swatted fly or fouled straw steaming on the barn floor. While overhead the fox squirrels curl under leaves stuffed in autumn down bowls of maple and easy providence. And here is this man, restless with his jars, his jugs, vacuum pumps, bales of alfalfa, tractors, faces of dead snowflakes, going for sandwiches, chili, hot coffee, somewhere in the city, the white city where the snow waits. Decatur, Illinois, has a population of about 100,000. And it's a heavily industrialized city in some desperate straits, as they are these days. Millikan University is there, and you know, if you come up and read the poem, that's one thing, but to write them, you have to have strategy. So that we go to catalogs here and whatever to try to write a poem that might reflect somehow the fact of a middle-sized city. There's a, imagine a town that has its main street called El Dorado, and next to it is Pershing. So I guess that's all we need to know. Baroque towers of Millikan's old main, DNA stretch of El Dorado, that drag franchised as they are these days, and Pershing old blackjack parallel and as bedight. This town surprises you, town leading into doors that may or may not be opened, like a work of Mahler with a heart wounded in it. Streets of sweat and yearning, they make everything in this steam-crowned city, all these air-bearing crankshaft casings, easy ice cream scoops, cardboard containers made by hands laced with razor cuts, pasteurized ice milk and pumps, and imitation bacon bits, who can say, from imitation hogs, and corn sweeteners, and gear case housings, stove knob inlays, creeper wheel assemblies, potato chips, so many things here, this very thingness smolders in the whorls of our fingers. Carburetor valve seats, concentrate, vinyl and fabric cleaner, neat's foot compound, 100% natural diaper, sweet blue raindrop, spider dance, centipede, hip hooray, kites laboring in the corridors of the air. St. John's Lutheran Cemetery, northeast of town, it is a verdant place. Tertoka, Schaubi, Samalka, Karash, Sudzara, Bricks, Tangius, Arts, Hungarians and Lithuanians, meat cutters and produce packers sleep here among many friends. And south along this green rectangle, a siding for robin egg blue tank cars, track old and waffled, it can't last long. This town has tomatoes born for the future, that hydroponic renewal, freight cars assembled by computers, and there are golf courses, a swimming pool, lake activities, prospects, a YMCA, a good downtown library, junior college, etc. Hard business and hardball times. Would that work could sweep us into heaven, rising in a chemical yeast. These old saints, they want to come home, walk through an open door, as a man might enter a woman, all in his hallowed bones, as if she knew or could know who he was. Lunchroom, New Berlin. I told him he needed his head trimmed a shadow. He said why, he was the hometown bald eagle where he came from. I wouldn't have believed him, what with his chin whiskers drizzling into his soup bowl. Why, he said last graduation the superintendent of schools in his town tripped on his own beard and broke both ankles, and now the old timers drinking coffee round back of the pharmacy draped their beards on his crutches, keep them out of the cigarette butts and stuff on the floor that way. I thought I would be polite, just give him a vague nod, but he went right at it, said anyone needed a haircut where he lived, they had to lift up the barber's eyebrow, see if he was awake or just standing at the window like a rock. I didn't believe that either, but he just jellied up a bun and went on expostulating. Told me where he came from, nobody went to the cemetery, but it wasn't like Oklahoma where those wheat farmers were so lean and dehydrated they used them for fence posts when they die, that is, except for the ones the woodpeckers get. No, sir, he told me, everyone is heavy in the haunch back there in Monticello. Great-chested, good-sound, smiling folks with hair all over them like pelts. When somebody dies in Monticello, they put him out in the yard. You can always tell which ones is shrubs because no family lets a starling sit in a relative. I humored him, of course, because we were having lunch together. But when he wanted to know would I like one of his hush puppies, I said I surely would not if it wasn't a chihuahua. I got him with that one, parted him right up the middle when I said that, don't you think? If you get a haircut in one of these small towns, usually the barber talks to the fellow who's getting the haircut, but often if that man is silent, somebody waiting does all the talking and everybody else just nods and says yes and no. Well, this is called watching a haircut. They don't put you down 6 feet anymore, just 42 inches. See, that's enough now. Why, it's hardly below frost. Well, they say you can't heave out. The vault's a ton and a half. And what about the water table? How about we get rain for a month? I asked them that, and they say, well, one did rise up on Polecat Creek near Chatham last year, 1st of March, but there was an admiral in it, so it was all right. I keep this bunch together in one section so it won't get out of hand. And here's one of the rare occasions when I enter the book, and this was a true event. We had a talent faculty and staff show at the university. The all-girl kazoo band, the wives' mothers' singles, they are dressed in white formals and wear blue sashes. They don't mind very much whether or not they play well, just so long as they know they all look beautiful. Isn't that delicious? One of the girls eases herself over to me. She reaches into her bodice with both hands and pulls out two kazoos. She says, see, I have two kazoos. And I say, oh, well, why, yes, you really do have two kazoos. This one's called Bulldog Crossing. You want to get to Kincaid? You drive down this road, turn west just before Taylorville. You pass the dump on your left, then reach Kincaid at the river, or east of it, I guess. Well, this place does have a strange name. Used to be a lot of bulldogs here, 100 or more bulldogs. That was before the stock market crashed. They like to sit where we are now, watching the trucks go south. Trucks was new then, and the road had good pavers, I think. It was something to see those dogs with pie-panned muzzles and cropped ears homing like magnets whenever a truck went by. But I tell you the truth, those dogs were just like people. Some days they just got tired sitting on this side the road, and then they would all stand up and go over to the other side. Used to be a big cottonwood there, and they liked to sit in its shadow, watching the trucks roll north. Must have been halfway to Decatur. So you understand how it was, them going back and forth and forth and back. Bulldog Crossing just naturally came to be called this place. Well, no, the dogs are all gone now. They were all overcome by ambition. Every one of them ran for election, and they all burst forth with healthy pluralities, as Edmund Burke would put it. Why, they made 3 governors and 65 congressmen. Those were truly honorable dogs. And there were several got on the Supreme Court, and some were senators and foreign ambassadors. You could say they were the best politicians for bulldogs there ever were, except for the one was a complainer. He never went any place, but he had a flea in his ear about something. You want to know about him? He went into writing, wrote this book, Portrait of the Young Dog as an Artist. Won a big prize. Hey, wait, I want to tell you, they made it a movie. John Wayne had a part in it. Rushing right along. It's called Soundings in Glacial Drift, and it's a collage in a number of parts. Try to tell you something about this central area. There is a 50-foot drop from the Shelbyville Moraine. It is something so gentle you cannot believe it. Then the Illinois Till Plain rolls the horizon west before you, a flat miracle that defeats the eye. At the County Line Road, the Macon and Christian County divide, there is a benchmark, copper green on a culvert wall. It is precisioned at the intersected baseline of the third principal meridian. This is the interior of our interior, pending from the numeraled stars. South of this place, through walls of dust, you can see glacial cames sucked from Wisconsin meltdowns, the ice 2 miles high then. Think of it. Fields black, dead grass along the edge of the road, silver machine shed, big still windmill, a blue sky and black trees, a new bridge in a level valley, fishermen coming from there down the Cerro Gordo-Cisco Road. On the curve out of La Place, no moraines here, it is flat like Auburn. There is a round water tower and small tourist cabins set there in the 30s. Cerro Gordo with crumbling red brick, Bud's HAC sump pump special, Farmer's Branch Building, 1887, a great house on the edge of town. There is always one with aging black cypresses around it, mansion going down to seed. Cisco is all crossroads and green bins and silos. You can look straight up to see them define the clouds. La Avenida de los Grain Elevators. The kids buy cokes at the antique store. You can get cartons of milk at the gas station. No one wastes land here on anything but crops. William Jennings Bryan, the Gold Cross, who can afford it? Only Russians and South Africans. North of 72 in Buffalo, the Methodist Church has a cross of split rails, split black locust, ancient and weathered and poor as the town. I think the congregation would tolerate a Presbyterian on it. There is a very fine Pleistocene outwash fronting Tom Lincoln's place. The Sangamon gouges that bluff with every spring raise, but summers you can walk below it and pick up stones streaked with copper or maybe a saucer-rimmed Chinese version with English castles. You wonder who sipped his coffee cool from it and when that was. Now, you can't write in the Sangamon Valley and ignore the awesome presence of Lincoln. So I've spent several days last summer at the Lincoln Tomb just watching the tourists come in, and the strategy was to handle the poem as a report. So it's Lincoln's Tomb, a report. And the quotations are accurate. Husband to wife with camera, can you get the whole tomb? No, she says from the viewfinder, but I've got Mr. Lincoln, I think. A terrorist got him, rendered him to an insane absolute, one of our martyred presidents. The Gutzon Berglum sculpture, the same on Mount Rushmore, Robert Todd marveled at it. He did not expect to see father again. Husband focuses on wife. She rubs the Berglum nose. A grandfather lifts two children, a small boy and his sister. It is the custom that everyone shines Mr. Lincoln's nose. I sit on a park bench, watch the people gathering, always the families and foreign groups, and now a busload of old tourists, and a sun-bronzed woman the nudists call a cottontail, her white behind peeking from under her shorts as she strolls to the tomb. Palace for Pharaoh, hedges of solemn yew and burning bush, and a dogwood on each side the entrance, camped there for blossoms in spring. No arch here, just the necessary post and lintel. Many languages spoken. I recognize Spanish, Italian, Chinese, but there are others. The world cares about this man, comes here to have its picture taken. And each family, its several selves, poses for a group portrait. This is essential in front of the tomb, like rubbing the polished nose. While deep within, the cenotaph spells his name and those numbers 1809, 1865. A small son to his father. I saw that. Was he in back of that thing? Yes, 10.5 feet behind the dark red Arkansas stone and 10 feet down, safe under tons of cement. It is all right, this tomb. His words hung in bronze here. Gettysburg Address, farewell to Springfield, second inaugural. The Almighty has his own purposes. Blood drawn with a lash, every drop paid with a sword. I expect it to wear as well as anything I have produced, a truth I thought needed to be told. This terrible war, if God wills it to continue. From the side at the end, at a distance, the Burglum sculpture seems enormous, a head on a judgment seat, something in front of the gate we need to dare touch. It tells us who we are, isn't that right? Or should have been, or who we have to be. Father, impatient to his son, you ask me questions I don't have any idea how to answer. A teenage boy exits the tomb. He is alone approaching the sculpture. He rubs it vigorously, taking his solitary goodbye. No magic here or sanctioned custom. His is the last fierce, affectionate touch we reserve for the dead. And now a small child, walking to the parking lot, stops in the sunlight. She is wearing a red beanie which supports a plastic propeller. She studies for a moment the shadow that revolves above her shadow and then goes on. Just read you a couple more. There was, in the 1700s, a group of people who evidently represented a new people in the country, because they were runaway bond servants and escaped slaves and remnants of native groups. And they had melded in the Kentucky Mountains, and they came down into Cincinnati and then settled in Indianapolis. And they have a very strong Muslim caste to them. It turns up in the names, among other things. They're mentioned in Cooper's The Prairie, and people are pretty sure that the little orphan Annie, who told the goblin stories in James Whitcomb Riley's poem, was a Ben Ishmaelite girl, because these were the tribe of Ben Ishmael. In 1908, there were genocide laws put on the books of Indiana, and they dispersed shortly after. The images, such as they appear in the poem, are taken from the Koran. Lines for the tribe of Ben Ishmael. Bound in sheaves, Nebuchadalama Basore, gone to Detroit and Chicago, gone to Philadelphia, gone to earth, all held, all sealed in the last dream of the pomegranate. Cambodians, Vietnamese, Russians, Armenians, Biafrans, Dutchmen, and Greek, Gypsy, Jew, the Rorschach for all the others. And that was in 1908 in Indiana, the year that could not be trammeled in its own time. For rapists, imbeciles, idiots, let there be surgeons when procreation is inadvisable. As the law came down like a blot on fool's cap, they clustered in the arbors of frost, and the night danced until dawn for them and their children. Carters of wood or wash or whatever, and their orphaned daughters who told the fierce stories, and those beggars in the streets who wore no robes of green silk or golden bracelets, the dangerous blind old men who mocked their eyes with blue vitriol. They were the sober hunters, Gamil Malamhe Hamela, anchoring their shanties on the White River mud flats, They did not search for paradise or dream of it even, because they knew God was not there walking the hedgerows in that walled garden. Shuri Amin Hayar, they went once each year northwest through Morocco, then summered by Mohammed, and fall edging winter crossed back over the Wabash where Mecca is, and on to Indianapolis. They had Tecumseh's blessing before he went to the dead these 1,000 years. The Kickapoo, who, I should explain, they were the ascendant historic native people in the valley. Some went to Kansas, one band went to Oklahoma, and one went all the way into Mexico and stayed there until the last several years when they moved back up to Texas. And their clan systems are still intact. And they have a custom. This is a people that have always fought. But the warriors at some time or other might ask to be forgiven, the cult hero, to forgive them so that they can come to a peaceful rest. But as Kickapoo, they know they may not be granted that. So I put that together with some student work that turned up in a class of mine who had a paper on ghost stories in Vietnam. The country is just inundated with stories of ghosts, the unplacated dead. And I wrote this poem called Kickapoo Veteran Home from Vietnam. How do you come home from a place so anxious with spirits, so many deaths, the half-souls walking the country? They have to be comforted, or they lurk in the village and snatch the child at the fire, salt in the mouth for everyone and the taste of blood. And I am home now, wanting my forgiveness because I have killed so many. I want that my own soul should come to a quiet place, because I am a landscape written over in grief. And yet I am from a people from the back of time who have not known anything except war. And so if my prayer is not answered, it will be the chance of our way. I am the child of my fathers. There's a sub-theme, man and woman theme. I resolve it in with a collage here called Sandalwood Poems, and it's from a chapbook by that name, and I put some of them in here. They are love poems. Always in your loving, there is so much sorrow. There is the wind uncertain in the crowns of summer maples. There is the everlasting conciliation of the tides. I offer you 10 meadows of fireflies. You give me one box of sandalwood. I circle this table. I do not come back to the place where I began, though I want to say that I do. Perhaps you are the one who is constant, really, a red warning light that never changes. I want to go a long way where I will find myself not as in a mirror, but as that other man who comes from the other side of time, who will merge with my spirit and achieve my body. I will wear him laughing when I return to you, coming back to the old place that was not mine. House, wind, sleep. We do not raise our voices. You hand me down my body. In the little county fairs, they often have a contest. It involves little girls who are about 4 years old, maybe. And the room is usually full of parents and relatives, and the girls come up one by one, and a very gentle announcer asks them questions about, you know, what do they want, what do they watch on television, and, you know, who are their parents, and this and that. And the girls answer, and then they do a little turnaround for the audience. And then somehow or other, one of them is selected as a princess. And I thought, supposing you had a little girl like that, but she had such blinding intelligence that she could remember even what was said at the moment of her conception, and that she would make a statement. And I came up with this poem called Prince's Candidate, Sangamon County Fair. Thank you for listening to me, but I must tell you I am not native to this county, because I was conceived far east of Broadwell in Indiana, my parents coming to Williamsville shortly after, and I was born there, and that was 5 summers ago, last June 21st. And that is how it is. I am the gnawed bone of my father's desire, the starlight of my mother's dreaming. I am the bean blossom of their happy needfulness. My mother luxuriously yawning, "Oh, you were wonderful." And my father, his face shining like an apple you ducked for in the kitchen on Halloween, "Did you really think so?" I am in other respects like everyone here. I am starred with Bethlehem. I will have my crown of thorns, but there will be hosannas too in my life and delectable mountains as in everyone's life. I can do hops. I like jacks on a rainy day. I can skip to blue heaven following a stone, and sometimes I bake sausages for my girlfriends, and Saturdays when the house is quiet, I like all the cartoons. But to be spellbound, that is special. That is when the TV news calls us to lives where everything is lost, and people stand somewhere else in their shadows, and they win over cruelty, as Adlai Stevenson said, in the courage of their fortitude. That is when no one can wrap them in packages or sell them anymore. It puts a stitch in my heart seeing them like that, those good prairie people facing what is beyond them in every direction. Oh, but forgive me prattling, and let me turn for you like a shaker in Kentucky so you can see me all around. And please accept this curtsy and my smile to you. Goodbye.
One more. That's not me saying goodbye. That's the prince's goodbye. Now on, I'll read it earlier in the program. This is one called Confluence.
The sun's eye gleams on the burnt black prairie, the winter blackened moraines of all conclusions, and the white egret ascetic alone with his promise, knowing where the river is, threads a fiery needle. It is always more than dawn that we looked for, something that we had not seen as we watched here gathered from the ashes of our vision. May new prayers and new fires, the beloved Pleiades, welcome the Kickapoo home, star daughters in their hoods of light, dancing at their zenith while the sun burns down the horizon. This world in peace, this late temple of darkening colors, it could not have been made for shambles. This green twilight of echoing voices as the sun hurls its fireball down the other side of the world. It is long miles through marsh grass, the Sangamon sifting to its ending, and beyond us, Illinois intensifies south beneath the eagles at Grafton, our ancient Mississippi, its wide, slow waters. Thank you.
Well, hope you've enjoyed this evening. Next month's reading will be on December 10th. Will feature Howard Schwartz, the San Francisco poet David Meltzer, and two of Missouri's best jazz guitarists, Lyle Harris and John Stewart. See you then. These little schedules are free and are up front. Please take one if you don't have one, and support your local poet, By River Styx.